talk is going to be about my response to that first question in the top. John Wheeler asked, if one did not know the Einstein equations in advance, how would one hope to derive it directly from first principles? And there are many different answers to this question. This one over there is the one that I'm going to be interested in, by Hajman, Kukash, and Teitelbaum, in a paper called Geometrial Dynamics Regained. I'm interested in that only towards my result, not that I'm going to need their result. It's just a nice way to introduce it. And I was too lazy to finish that, but they go on to say, does one may hope that first principles of geometrial dynamics can be adapted more readily to the quantum theory and lead to a deeper understanding of how the macroscopic space-time theory grows from the quantum geometrial dynamical roots. And this is how I hope I will end the lecture, with an inkling of how space-time picture can grow from geometrial dynamical roots. Okay, so what do they mean by geometrial dynamics? Geometrial dynamics. So the picture that they paint is, suppose you have some space-time here, and I mean, I have the usual picture here. Okay. And suppose you have some hypersurface in there, and suppose there is a four metric here, okay, and there's a foliation, and or at least there is one sheet. And now you want to know how quantities that depend, functionals, let's say, functions of this on this space, will change, or functions on the foliations will change when you change the foliation, when you change the hypersurface. So you can do different kinds of things to the hypersurface. You can kind of push it forward, right? You can stretch it around. And functionals that are defined here will change in a certain way because this is changing along space-time. All right, so what they did was, first they said, okay, so suppose we change this hypersurface in a certain direction, and then we stretch it, or we do it the opposite way. What kind of algebra do we get for these deformations? And this is called the hypersurface deformation algebra. And I can write it, I can write the hypersurface deformation algebra. Now suppose that there's an orthogonal component to the hypersurface, and I'm going to call this X perp, and then there's some component tangent to the hypersurface, and I can call it XA. And now, so they build an algebra from this. So let's build this algebra. It's X perp 1, X 1A, and X2 perp, X2A. Okay. And now this, so for this component, we're going to get X1A, X2 perp, comma A. I'm going to use comma for derivatives, minus the opposite. So I'm usually going to just do this. And that's right. So this is the perp component, and then the other component is just x1 perp, x2 perp, no, x2a, x2 perp a, sorry, minus x2 perp x1 perp a. And here you have to use the metric to form a vector field from this. And then you have also the algebra. This is just a vector field. Okay. So this is the double that you get, right? This term and this term. Okay, this is nice. And they say, okay, this is nice. This is kind of represents how things should change if we deform the hypersurfaces in a space-time. Yes. I'm sorry, what?
To see that this is a spatial diffeomorphism.
To see that these are the spatial diffeomorphisms? Sure. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by to see. Yeah, I mean, this is the spatial commutator of vector fields, right?
Yeah. So,
oh, okay. Yeah, like have a hypersurface here and then have it evolve to a different hypersurface here. Is that what?
No,
what's
the picture?
Wasn't
I
gonna get it right?
Why don't you take the talk?
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's a really nice picture to see this one.
Ah, okay. Yes, yeah, I'll do the picture in the original view. Yes.
If you have two normal deformations, let's say function with various in space, and you see this bigger.
If you do one and the other, you just get a diffeomorphism related to it, right?
If you do the other way around, you get it in the other direction.
Yeah.
So it's a commutator.
That's right. So, so you're talking about this term.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. But then what they ask is, okay, but now suppose we arrive at the Hamiltonian framework for GR, right? How do you do that? You start from the Eisen-Hilbert action. Then you do a Legendre, you do a hypersurface decomposition, you do a Legendre transform. And you get, in the end, two constraints. One of the constraints is of this form. A half, there's a 1 over g. And the other constraint is just, actually, this is better. Okay, so this is basically because you get Lagrange multipliers in the Legendre transform of the action, and you vary with respect to them, you get these initial value constraints. But of course, in the Hamiltonian framework, right, in this case, you find that the Hamiltonian is purely constrained. So the total Hamiltonian has a form. Let's call this H, and this is HA, HB in this case. So you find that the total Hamiltonian has this form, NH plus NA, NA, HA. Okay? And to find how G dot, what G dot is, you just do the Poisson bracket of this and this. And this is gonna be equal to G dot. AB. All right. So here, what they are saying. So G dot. Yeah, I mean. Well, yeah. So here, what they are saying is, if you calculate the Poisson bracket of these quantities with G, with the G of a hypersurface or the moment of a hypersurface, you also find out how they evolve and how functionals of them will evolve with respect to that. And then, in fact, you do. You work out Poisson brackets of different smearings of these two. So let's say to take the example that Bianca mentioned, you take this H of N1 and you H of N2, and it turns out you get exactly H of A of this thing here. Okay. And so with N1 and N2 instead of X1 and X2 perp. And so the question is, all right, so you kind of get the same algebra from the Hamiltonian constraints, but you went through this long process just to get to the Hamiltonian constraint, the Hamiltonian form of GR. So they ask is basically, wait, can we find just the form, can we invert the logic and find the form of these constraints from just saying they have to establish basically this commutation algebra? Like, can we derive the constraints from the algebra that they form. Okay, and they impose some conditions, and then the answer is yes. Basically, they do. They rederive this from this algebra of deformations, hypersurface deformations. So I'm not going to be entirely interested in this. This is just to introduce the kind of derivation that I'm thinking about. Let's see if I can work this. Okay. So when you have functions in phase space, right? This is a very, I'm just going to define first class in more geometric terms. So those of you who are familiar with first class don't really need to pay attention. G and pi. My phase space is G and B and pi and B. But I was just going to define something prior to that. Suppose you have a given set of constraints, chi alpha, let's say like this. And if they're regular and things, they will define some kind of surface in phase space. Okay, the regular value will define surfaces. But more than this, each one of these will define a symplectic flow, right? I mean, how do they define this? You define it by acting on functions as just a Poisson bracket. So basically, I could call, I mean, this was bad notation because it's x and chi, but I could call the vector field that it generates its action on f, I could call it this. So you have some vector fields, and they could be, in principle, all over the place, right? Now, a first-class set of constraints is one for which each one of these vector fields stays in the surface defined by the whole set. Okay, so you have this surface defined, and these vector fields all stay on this surface. If they start on the surface, if they have their initial point in the surface, they stay on the surface. This is basically the concept, the geometric concept of first class. Okay, so basically this is all I need to introduce my own two postulates for Wheeler's question. And so my first one will be in GR phase space. Okay, maybe this is an assumption for everything. So here my phase space is comprised of GB, pi B, and I have the canonical Poisson bracket. Okay. And now my first assumption will be, let's first get all the constraints. So all constraints. Okay, so sorry, that's not what I mean. So I'm writing the same thing. Yeah, all constraints that are first class, that are covariantly first class. So I'm going to assume also that all of my constraints they will be in a certain sense covariantly conserved, or they are compatible with the spatial diffeomorphisms. Okay. So each of these set of constraints that I'm finding here has to be compatible with the diffeomorphisms. So all constraints that are spatially covariant first class. Covariant and first class. Okay. This is one of the, so here all I'm assuming is that on their surface, the flow of these things, if they're aided sometimes by the diffeos, but they stay on that surface. And the second thing that I want is that, so suppose I want to find all the doubles. So let's say I want to find all the doubles, xi or chi, no, right, I'm using chi. So chi I and chi j, this is not a Poisson bracket, it's just a double, such that the Poisson bracket between chi I and chi j is invertible is invertible everywhere. Okay. And there's a technical way of asserting this, that I want it to be invertible. In fact, it's a little bit more subtle than this. I don't want it to have an infinite dimensional kernel anywhere. I'm all right if it has a finite dimensional kernel, because then you have an algorithm to kind of extract the invertible part of it. And this is basically something that we do in shape dynamics. You find something that has a kernel, and then you extract parts of it that makes it invertible. So I'm going to be all right if it has a finite dimensional kernel. I don't want it to have an infinite dimensional kernel anywhere. So the way that you find out this is that because of the following. So usually these things, when you have functionals of phase space, so all constraints, by all constraints, what I'm going to mean is like all polynomials in those variables. For simplicity, let's start with that. It's not what I'm going to prove, but let's start with that. And by invertible here, I mean that, so let's say this is, I don't know, RAB and pi B. I did not consider this constraint, but and something here. I don't know, trace pi, whatever. And you have some smearing, let's say N. The thing is, you have some operator here, some delta of N plus, you know, stuff. Maybe just delta of N. And if this operator is elliptic everywhere, this is a condition, it has a finite dimensional kernel. Okay, and this is how you I impose this second demand is that the operator deriving from this has to be elliptic. The operator resulting from the Poisson bracket has to be elliptic, so it has a finite dimensional kernel. So let's draw a picture of this. This is basically what I want. So I have a picture of this. Wasn't a very good picture. Okay, so this is the picture of what I want. This is, let's say, chi I. And this is chi j. And you know, they have their flows, and they're keeping their flows here and here. And I want them to kind of be always transverse. So I actually want a little bit, I want their flow to be transversal everywhere. But let's keep it with this picture here. And so this is the picture that I'm looking at. And I'm searching for all pairs of constraints that have this property, basically. And this is what I call I think we've been calling it actually duality. It's because if you think about this as the constraint surface with the gauge transformations, this is a section, right? This is kind of a section of the gauge transformations. And it's a section for both of them. So they kind of meet in a section for both of them. So you can say in some sense that they have the same observables. And this is why we say that these two theories can establish some duality. Okay, so what did I actually prove? I didn't prove that these are the only ones. This is just a publicity stunt. But what I did prove was that, for instance, if you take, let's say, a big, let's take this one. This is the one I took, plus beta. RAB plus gamma R. Well, here I took any power of R with arbitrary coefficients for each n, plus A pi B pi B plus B pi squared plus C pi. Let's add plus D. And here, let's put the right. So this is the form of constraints that I took. So for arbitrary, I didn't go to arbitrary lengths because the calculations get super complicated when you start adding more curvature terms. But, and the theorem that I get is the following. This is the impressive part, is that the only double that I get, so for this ones, there exists a unique double, unique such double. And they're formed by basically one of them is, you might have guessed it, you get actually the factor of half here, which was correct. I might have written it wrong. No, I wrote it right. You actually do get that factor of half plus C, and you get the other one, P plus D. Anyways. So these are the only two. These are chi 1 and chi 2, basically. Okay? Here's what I mean by deriving GR. I didn't assume GR anywhere. I didn't assume space-time, really, like HKT. I just assumed these constraints existing and having these properties that they might be expressible by a dual relation. And this limits severely, these two principles limit severely what are the possible sets of dual constraints that you have. And so I would like actually, I could conjecture, maybe I can still use this board. No, to be honest, I didn't even add this. I just, in the papers, I didn't even add the, but it, I'm, so this is, I'm very sure it works out, but I didn't even, I don't know, I didn't add matter fields or the cosmological constant, I'm quite sure, but this is kind of also conjectural. Originally, I just did this. Without the C here, it comes out. And without the D, but yeah, I didn't. But so the conjecture would be like, one of the assumptions I did not, so there are hidden assumptions here, as I said, there's a lot of fine print. One of the assumptions that I use is that you cannot have A, B, and C go to zero. You have to have at least some momenta there because you need, at least how I justify this is you need time to appear somehow. Otherwise, it's entirely intrinsic to the hypersurface. This is one of the assumptions. For this case, I think it's the only assumption. So here the conjecture would be that it works for everything with a momenta. Works for maybe all polynomials. Even if I do derivative coupling, you see here I didn't include terms like this, which are derivative coupling. So conjecture is, it works for everything as long as you include some momenta. It depends non-trivially on the momenta for everything. This is the conjecture. And of course, you still have a one parameter here, which is basically the cosmological constant. And in this case, it's like York time it would be if you parameterize this. You can only go further, I think, at least. I won't do any more calculations with this unless I do some computer program because it's really a pain to do all these brackets. And, okay, so you might say the same thing. I could have said here that it's a desire to have, it's aesthetic in origin, that I just wanted to have rederived general relativity from duality. That's what I wanted, and I think that's already pretty interesting. But now I want to show you that there is a further argument for why this could be a little bit preferred or self-selected. And this is because I didn't put it in the board, but to quote HKT, I would say, hope that the first principles of geometric dynamics, no, that's not it. Lead to a deeper understanding of how the macroscopic space-time theory grows from the quantum geometric dynamical roots. So this part involves something that me and Tim did about a year ago. It's called symmetry doubling. And it requires a BRST formulation of a Hamiltonian BRST formulation of constraints. But that's more technical than this. I'm not going to try to use too much of it. Yes.
So their statement is actually if you assume the constraint algebra.
That's right.
Then
you get the right constraints.
Kind of amazing constraints.
Yes, that's right.
And if I understand your claim correctly.
You what?
If I understand your claim correctly, you say actually that you don't need to assume the algebra.
Yes. I don't. I assume properties. I'm assuming these properties of these dual sets. I don't assume a form of the algebra.
Ah, so you have, yeah. So you don't use the algebra, but you use two.
Yes. Because of this, right, Bianca? Because I want two theories that are dual to each other, and I'm saying what theories can be dual to each other.
And so for two you make the angles that form.
Yes. So sorry, for two I make the answers what? Sorry? Okay. Yeah, I mean, those are the conditions, and it's always a double of constraints that I'm going to derive from this, right? Because I want them to represent duality. And yeah, so one of them is that they're first class, so that they're consistent. They're consistent with the diffeos, and the other is that they kind of have this intersection everywhere, though. Well, there's no derivative coupling here, for instance. Yeah, there's no term, for instance, there's no term pi b, rab, right? Yeah, I probably could, I actually did some other calculations for higher. And it works out because here's what happens. I mean, what happens is that when you calculate the bracket, at least somewhere they're going to have an infinite dimensional kernel, and then they don't have the interpretation of transversality. I can't even fix them to have the interpretation of transversality. And that's what happens if I include higher terms. I mean, I don't know. I could try to, you know, but. Tim, I think, has a computer program to calculate brackets, so I think I'm going to borrow that and try to.
Not for arbitrary.
Not for arbitrary, okay. Yeah, they're around? Well, that would be great to know. Okay, so let me just tell a little bit more about what I don't claim it is a self-selected selection principle, but I think it might be, coming from quantum mechanics, or at least a BRST formulation of the same thing. Okay, so when you have first-class constraints, you can formulate these constraints as in a BRST environment, which includes more variables. It includes Gauss momenta. And it is done in that way so that, in a certain sense, the BRST variable, which is what is generating the gauge transformations, will still maintain the BRST invariance even after gauge fixing. So you can like gauge fix and still maintain the kind of the BRST invariance of the system. So I can get more into it, but I don't think that's going to be valuable. So. Let's suppose this is the BRST charge, which is just representing our original symmetries, let's say chi alpha, but now including more variables, right? I don't know, eta plus something. And the property that this has to satisfy to be a valid gauge transformation, something called new potency. So let me just write this. And I can actually write down what omega is for each one of those systems, if you want. So me and Tim, we actually did this about a year ago. And this, I can write down for first rank system, what they call, I can write down the general form. But I don't think that's important unless you want me to go deeper into this. But then there's another thing. If you have, let's say, besides the symmetries, besides the first class constraint, you have a true Hamiltonian, okay, in the original system. Now you're extending the system. You also need to extend this true Hamiltonian to a Hamiltonian that is BRST invariant. Okay, but we're also going to gauge fix the Hamiltonian. So what you get when you extend this, you get this, and then you get plus some other term here, which is basically the commutator of the Hamiltonian with the constraints, with the Gaussian moment that has to be have Gauss number zero. But then, more importantly, this is the term that I want to show you. And this is the gauge fixing of the BRST symmetry. And this has to be done in such a way that the whole thing remains BRST invariant. Okay? So if I, by BRST invariance in this context, is always taking the commutator with the BRST charge. This has to be zero for BRST invariance for something here. Okay. And the properties of this gauge fixing, well, they're such that you know the action you have to be able to define propagators. So they're kind of loosely defined. You can still have a lot of things here. But in our case, we can actually we have a different symmetry. So we can build two BRST symmetries, omega one. Right, corresponding to our first system, and let's say omega 2, a BRST symmetry corresponding to our second system. And now, since we have no true Hamiltonian, right, this goes to nothing, this goes to nothing, the gauge fixed BRST Hamiltonian is just this term. But now what we do in symmetry doubling, what we did in symmetry doubling was you replace the gauge fixing fermion, just a random gauge fixing fermion, it's called, by the second symmetry. So actually you have to use because this has to be Gauss number zero, so you have to change the Gauss by the Gauss momenta. And now you have this is the gauge fixed Hamiltonian for purely constrained systems with this type of gauge fixing. Okay? And look at that's the interesting property of this is that now your gauge fixed BRST Hamiltonian has two sets of symmetries. This Hamiltonian now has this symmetry, omega 1 equals 0, and omega 2h equals, well, already. So this is what we call symmetry doubling, is that the gauge fixed the BRST Hamiltonian for this appropriately chosen gauge fixing fermions has to have two sets of symmetries. So this is an argument for why saying, but look, these are the same principles to have symmetry doubling. These are the same principles that I implemented there. If these constraints satisfy that, those two things, then a BRST treatment of them would incur in symmetry doubling. Would say, okay, maybe the quantum mechanical version of it has something special happening. And so that's why I say that. Okay, maybe it is initially aesthetic. It's nice to have this duality picture. But maybe there's a little bit more behind it. Maybe there is some self-selection principle coming from quantum mechanics that prefers these two sets of assumptions. And I guess that's it. It was a short talk.
So you're now describing the
So yeah, so I can. So the gauge. Okay, so I can describe the intersection. The intersection is what some people called, for instance, Moncrief, Fisher, other people, they called the conformal reduction of Einstein's equations. So the intersection is almost kind of Einstein's equations, but it reproduces these Einstein spacetimes that have CMC foliations. And I mean, so I wasn't going to describe. How much do you want me to describe? Do you want me to like write the equations of motion? That's a little complicated, or. That's right. Okay. All right. So, so that surface there is basically okay. So that surface there, what happens? So let me give you a little bit of background then, and say tell you a little bit about Julian Barber's ideas. Okay. So lots of people have thought for a long time that relationalism also requires you to say that scale is only defined relative to each other, right? So the diffeomorphism invariant says, look, there's no meaning in a point being here. It's only here in relation to other points. But then other people wanted to go further and say, well, we also need to have scale invariance. There's no meaning of something being this size here. It's only this size relative to another size. And lots of people try to implement this for four dimensions. And I mean, you can do it, but so far these theories haven't actually like superseded GR in any way, or they haven't gotten rid of the faults of GR, let's say. Now, Julian Barber always believed in this thing that Bianca was mentioning earlier, that you know, time is change, or you can only tell that time is passing if space has changed somehow, and. So he was saying, okay, so let's forget about this four-dimensional scale invariance. Let's implement 3D scale invariance. Okay. So if you implement 3D scale invariance, what does this mean? Remember I was telling you about this flow of these vector fields, right? This flow of the flow that implements bioinvariance is exactly trace pi equals zero, or trace pi, let's say. You can easily see these. Let's do the calculation here quickly for a parameter, a gauge parameter here. You can derive this. So this is trace pi. So this is pi AB, GAB. All right. So if I do this Poisson bracket, I'm going to get just rho GAB. Right? And if I do the same thing with pi AB here, I'm going to get minus rho pi AB. So in a sense, this implements bioinvariance, spatial bioinvariance. But it also implements a gauge fixing. So basically what Julian found, it implements this gauge fixing, right? Pi equals zero. In HKT, they actually derive the fact that these things have to be obeyed at an initial value if by evolution in the geometric dynamic equations, you have to arrive at the same surface. Here, I'm not caring about that. HKT is the Hodgman-Kukach-Teitelboehm. So basically, this arrives at the fact that the only space-time that can have a representation, if you have a space-time that has a representation that is via invariance, it has to obey something like this. Okay. And then you can reduce a system. So to reduce a system, the usual way that it's done, for instance, by York, is you have the original canonical variables like this. And then you split this variable into more variables. You find, let's say, a section. Let's say we're on the sphere. Then you find a unit. You find a preferred metric on the sphere, right? The unit metric, the round sphere metric. And then you have a reference density. And then you split this GAB into a conformal factor and another. So let's say, okay, so I want to split this JB into a JB bar AB that will have determinant equals to 1, and another part, which is basically square root of G over square root of my reference density. Okay. And this is here has unit determinant, and then you also split this. I don't know. I can show the whole thing, but I don't know if that's going to be useful for you guys. Pi and just trace pi. Okay, so now I have four variables. I don't know why I put this many in parentheses here. But you have four. I've further split these variables into these. And then you rewrite the scalar constraint now with these variables, and you call this phi. And it turns out that if you do this gauge fixing, you can eliminate the scalar constraint and this gauge fixing at the same time. So trace pi equals a constant, let's say, tau squared g, by finding a preferred kind of conformal factor here. And you get reduced phase space variables by this and this. And when you input this into the action, you also get a Hamiltonian for this reduced theory over there. And this is called the Fisher-Moncrief conformal reduction of Einstein's equation. So I can write it down, but I mean, I don't know if it's going to be useful. It's just a way of expressing the theory. You have to separate the variables and say, what is the theory in this intersection? And this is the theory that you get. In this case, look, I'm not really caring about space-time, so I don't care for things like the lapse. For me, the lapse is just a Lagrange multiplier. For me, the lapse can be anything. Yeah, I mean. Yes. To do this and, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So maybe what you're saying is related to the York decomposition of between the the trace and the traceless part. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's thank Enrico.
Thank you.
And we have plenty of time for more questions.
Oh, good. Sorry. Yeah, I forgot. Okay, so how do I get this back here? This is the middle one. So should be this mid. Okay, so it's good that you asked. The thing is that if I have this, if I found from what I found from this mechanism is this intersection, right? It's this intersection here. Now, the problem with the intersection is that I showed you have to separate the variables, you have to reduce, and you have to solve equations and put that back in. It's a very complicated description that you have of the theory here. Okay? And there are basically two ways of making this theory nicely expressed in the metric variables. Right? I want to express this back again in JB and pi AB. All right? And now there are two different ways. I can do it. This is shape dynamics, and this is ADM. If I can re-extend this to include, because that's what gauge usually does, right? The gauge is important because you can express things locally, right? If you have gauge redundancy, you could always express things in a gauge fixed way or in a reduced way, but you find known localities that way. But when you introduce gauge, you can express everything locally again in a nice form. And this is what happens here. You have two descriptions that use the full thing here. So SD has, let's say, conformal invariance, and this has refoliation invariance. So you have two different sets of symmetries, but they're basically two different descriptions. Of course, ADM in this case here, I'm not considering it coming from a space-time perspective, so I don't care about the lapse, for instance. again. This is so, I should put this under quotes. It's not really ADM. Well, it's a slightly extended version of ADM. Oh, you weren't, sorry, yeah. Okay, yeah. No, okay. So we have already, so me and Tim also did some work about adding different types of matter. So for instance, for Young Mills fields, all these things go through. But if you actually add like massive scalars, then you might have some obstructions. And there's a regime of the density of these massive scalars in which things still go through. But if they break this certain regime, I don't know what that means. I haven't had time to look at it more carefully. But if you break that regime, something weird happens. I'm not sure if something weird might happen. Let's see. Let's put it that way.
I know that you can couple a standard model that's three level conformal invariant, but then configuration three conformal invariant. So would you expect that your conformal invariant, even if you stick to GR at this gate fixing, would you expect that this conformal invariant breaks down when you quantize it?
Not this one. No, but, look, and also, There are different notions of conformal invariance, right? That you're using four-dimensional conformal invariance in what you're saying. But to be honest, I don't know what the answer is to that. I don't think so there are the whole question of anomalies, which would be breaking the invariance through quantization. And this I have looked at there's a cohomological approach to anomalies, to finding anomalies. And basically you find, okay, there's these conditions called the Vesemino conditions that any anomaly has to satisfy. And these are algebraic. This gives you like a cohomology, gives you a chain. And then you try to find what terms can possibly survive that. That doesn't mean you find the anomalies, because to find the anomalies, you actually have to quantize. You actually have to write the graphs and everything. But you find the candidate anomalies. You find if there is an anomaly, it will be of this form. You don't find the normalization of it. And I did that for the symmetry of shape dynamics. And what you find, I mean, I can also write it down, but what you find is that you kind of have to split the anomaly in two ways. One is a time anomaly. Okay, so. Let's say this is the symmetry of shape dynamics. So one is a time anomaly. So this is no longer going to be zero. It's going to be something h bar here, and actually this is it's going to be ghost two form. And the other thing is that you find is that the Hamiltonian of shape dynamics doesn't propagate this anymore. And this is what is called a time anomaly. This is a ghost number one. And this has two components. You find this has one component. One component of this is always local. This is always local for shape dynamics. But one component of this is non-local. But all the rest, if this component that is non-local, which satisfies a functional differential equation of a certain type, if this is zero, if you demand locality of the anomaly, then everything vanishes and there's no anomaly. But I don't know. I mean, this is still, like I said, I haven't quantized it. I used a Hamiltonian gauge cohomology kind of approach, and I find that that if you demand locality, there's no anomaly, but there might be solutions to the functional differential equation, and then you have different types of anomalies. You also have an anomaly here, which is an interesting term, quadratic and curvature and stuff like that, like usual anomalies, you know, usual F mu nu are the anomalies, and so this would be a similar one, more or less, actually. Okay, yeah. Yes, that's right. Okay. Now, let's look for it. Ah.
You have the gauge fixing fermion there as thing as a kernel, so there is one component that is zero there. You should end up with a physical Hamiltonian.
That's right.
There.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So look, I know how it works in the classical sense. And for the PRST framework, maybe it goes through. Because, in fact, the H naught that you get from shape dynamics is invariant under both sets of symmetries. And, I don't know. What usually you can say is that if I add, where is it? Yeah, if I have these constants here, then there will be a finite dimensional kernel. But then I have to adapt the symmetry to leave a Hamiltonian along that line. And that's what actually how you generate the Hamiltonian of shape dynamics. You kind of restrict a little bit these symmetries, and then something is left to run on that surface there. And yeah, this requires these terms. Otherwise, you gauge fix completely, and there's no time evolution at all. But
what I'm confused about is that if you consider that constraint as your gauge fixing, and you start from the DRC formulation, the original Hamiltonian is pure constraint, so the term there is zero.
Yeah, but then the omega is going to be different. Yeah. Yeah, and then I don't know if that's going to be a good gauge fixing fermion. I mean, yeah, you have to rethink how you're going to split these things. We can talk about this later.
Any further questions? Comments? No? Okay, if not, let's thank Enrique again.